It's Twin Bills, the Red Sox podcast from the sports department of the Providence Journal, featuring Red Sox beat writer Bill Koch, along with sports editor Bill Corey. Now, Twin Bills.
Hello and welcome to another Moonlight edition of the Twin Bills podcast. This is Bill Corey, sports editor of the Providence Journal. With me, as usual, is the likewise nocturnal Bill Koch. Bill, we are here again in the wee hours after we worked on putting out the Wednesday Providence Journal because we had some news today, and that news is the Hall of Fame announcement came out, and to no one's surprise, Yankees great Derek Jeter got in easily, as he well should. And to some people's surprise, I suppose, Larry Walker, in his last year of eligibility, also got in. So unlike podcasts of the past where we obviously focus on the Red Sox, this is more of an MLB-wide podcast. So why don't we just start off with the easy ones here, Bill. Jeter, no one has an argument that he should not be in the Hall of Fame.
In fact, there was only one voter who argued this. Jeter was nearly unanimous, 396 out of 397 ballots cast.
Right.
You know, not all those votes have been made public yet, and some of them might not. It is your option when you're a Hall of Fame voter to have your vote kept private going forward.
And to be clear, you are not a Hall of Fame voter. Neither am I.
I am not
a
Hall of Fame
voter. You
have
to be on the beat for like 35 years or something before they give you a vote.
It's 10 years continuously, either covering a team as a beat writer or covering baseball on a national level. So It does take it takes some time. The idea, I think, there is to get familiar with the generation of players who you're going to be voting on. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you'll have seen 10 years worth of player in the league. By the time I start voting for Hall of Fame, which I hope to do, I hope I'm in the industry and covering baseball long enough, you're going to have guys like Mike Trout on the ballot.
Right.
That'll
be an easy one.
Well, that'll be an easy one. Right. But you'll have the great players of this generation.
Right.
I do know that, from the writers who I'm familiar with, they take this process very seriously. It is the greatest honor in the game, in my mind. Aside from, winning a championship or winning a most valuable player, being a Hall of Famer is immortal. You're there with the greats, whether it's, Babe Ruth or Ty Cobb or Henry Aaron or Willie Mays. Your name is aside theirs in Cooperstown, and it's a really serious responsibility. And I think the voters, the electorate, I think they all view it that way.
As they well should. I mean, once you're a Hall of Famer, you're always a Hall of Famer, right? You are introduced as Hall of Famer, John Doe. And you're right. I think it's something that most of the writers, at least the people that I've come across and have known and worked with over the years who had the privilege of voting, take it very seriously. It's not something that they don't just go online and say, okay, well, who's got the highest WAR? We'll just go with that guy.
That's right.
That's
right. So Jeter, obviously, a slam dunk for me. If I had a vote, I certainly would have put him in. His career numbers, his sustained excellence for so long, I think is probably what sets him apart. Obviously his performances in October, he has 5 World Series rings. He was fortunate enough to be playing for the Yankees during that time. But you look at his slash line in the postseason, 308 hitter, 838 OPS. You compare that to the regular season, 310 hitter, 817 OPS. So he's actually more powerful, more impactful, just as good a hitter against what you would expect to be the most elite pitching the game has to offer in that space. So a guy who always rose to the occasion, seemed like he had almost a natural understanding of the moment, and clearly someone who belongs in the Hall of Fame.
The thing about Derek Jeter to me, and I've heard this argument made over the years, in that he wasn't always the greatest shortstop in the game. He may never have been actually the greatest shortstop in the game in the years he played. I mean, he played with, in the same years as Alex Rodriguez when A-Rod was the shortstop. Obviously, Red Sox fans remember Nomar Garciaparra.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some years that Nomar's numbers eclipsed Derek Jeter's numbers.
No question.
but the thing about Jeter that always impressed me, and obviously you and I were raised in New England and Red Sox fans. So, the sight of the Yankees didn't exactly warm the cockles of our hearts.
No.
But for me, I've always given that begrudging respect to Jeter because he was such an Iron Man. I mean,
right.
he always played. If you looked at his, if you look at his career numbers, I mean, he's playing 150 games almost every year.
Right.
And he was, and he's been in the league. He was in the league forever. Obviously, a winner. Somebody who played in the microscope or the bright lights of New York, let's say, never really had any big scandals, you know. I mean,
no.
He was kind of known as sort of a little bit of a playboy and stuff, but there was nothing really huge, you know.
His starting nine off the field is one for the books.
Absolutely.
If you want to Google his personal relationships.
But he, he was always really good, always there for his team, came up clutch when they needed him. And, you know, as a Red Sox fan, you hated seeing Derek Jeter in the box with runners on base when you know that he could hurt you, because oftentimes he would.
You mentioned the games played and just his ability to punch the clock every single day. If you look at his seasons, aside from when he was a call-up in 1995 and he played 15 games, 2013 he only played 17 games. He was injured then.
Right.
His 18 other years, he was Rookie of the Year in 96. The 17 other seasons, he was in the top 10 of the AL MVP voting 8 times. Which means he's a top 10 player in the American League 8 full seasons
right.
out of 17, and a ninth when he's the Rookie of the Year.
Right.
Just consistent excellence year in and year out. He get MVP votes in 2 other years, 3 other years, actually. So, you know, just consistently good on a consistently good team. The face of baseball's dynasty. And, you know, as we've seen with other athletes in baseball and other sports, a lot of times it's very difficult to handle that burden and still perform. And he managed to do it with, you know, incredible grace and professionalism.
Well, we'll go from the no-brainer Hall of Fame inductee to the other guy. The other guy was Larry Walker, who was in his last year of eligibility, longtime Colorado Rocky. And, you know, Bill Reynolds, who is a colleague of ours, longtime journal columnist, and all around sage when it comes to sports, has a great line. I'm sure it's not his original line, but it's something that I've heard him say many times, and I completely agree with. And that is, you know, a Hall of Famer when you see one.
Sure.
And Derek Jeter is a Hall of Famer.
Right.
I think Larry Walker, you really have to kind of bend yourself into a pretzel to come out and say, yeah, he's a Hall of Famer. Now, I understand that the easy thing to do when it comes to Hall of Famers is to point to somebody who's in the Hall of Fame and say, well, if Harold Baines is a Hall of Famer, then this, and I get it, but I don't think I or you would probably be voting for Harold Baines either. So the thing with Larry Walker, obviously, is that he played many years. He came up with the Expos, I want to say.
Correct.
Played many years, I want to say 8 or 10 years or something like that for Colorado.
10 seasons, correct.
And, you know, we know what's happening in Colorado with the air and the less resistance on the ball.
Yep.
And if you look at his, as everyone has, his home road splits, they tell quite the story. He played 1,002 games on the road. It's not just Coors Field, but on the road. And then 986 games at home, many of which were in Coors Field.
Right.
And his batting average at home was .348. His batting average on the road was .278.
Yeah.
Home runs on the road, .168.
Mm-hmm.
Home runs at home, .215. And his OBP on the road, .370, at home, .431. And you get the pattern here,
right?
He was a much better hitter. And it's not his fault, right? He was playing where they signed him. But he was a much better hitter in Coors Field. And to me, that just, I don't know, that just waters down his candidacy.
It's a very difficult discussion. We broke this into categories a little bit, and I had Larry Walker and Todd Helton listed as the Coors guys.
Right.
You know, because you got two guys.
And that's not because they're drinking Coors.
No, no.
Well,
Although they may well have been.
They may be, but not during the game as far as we can tell.
But you got two guys who played the majority of their careers, in Helton's case, his entire career,
right.
with the Rockies. You know, Walker started with the Expos, went to the Rockies, finished with the Cardinals in a couple of years. He was the MVP in 1997 with Colorado. That was a year where he had an 1169 OPS at home and 1176 OPS on the road. So he was consistently excellent across any ballpark that he was in. That was his 30-year-old season.
Mm-hmm.
He had several other years with Colorado where his OPS was 300 and sometimes 400 points lower on the road.
On the road.
If you look at 2003, for example, he had a 1021 OPS at home, 766 on the road.
Wow.
2000 was 1062 at home, 770 on the road. That's not an all-star player. That's not even, you know, a sort of average production middle of the order outfielder.
Right.
You know, so you would look at that and you would say, how much of this was really manufactured in Coors Field? His career slash line at Coors in 597 games, 381, 462 on base, 710 slugging at Coors Field. Career in 1988 games, it's 313, 400, 565, 965 OPS. All good numbers, but all significantly enhanced over a third of those games playing at Coors Field. You know, so Walker, to me, was a guy who I wouldn't necessarily have voted for. I understand from the writers who covered him, he's one of the good guys in the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody who did end up playing in a World Series with the Cardinals. Postseason, 28 games, 230, 350, 510, 860 OPS, no rings.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily move the needle like some other guys would in the playoffs. You know, so I think that the electorate as a whole might have looked at this and thought, this is Walker's last year on the ballot. Jeter is really the only slam dunk guess that we have.
Right.
Are we going to put him in alone, or am I going to use one of my 10 available selections to put a guy in who I like,
right,
who's a good story, who feels good to vote for? And I think largely that's why Larry Walker ended up with 76.6% of the vote.
Just enough to get in. 75 is the threshold, right?
Correct.
And, you know, that really shouldn't be the criteria, whether he's a good guy or he's a jerk. You know, obviously Ty Cobb was not a very good guy. He got in. People will say that Jim Rice had to wait a long time because he was sort of...
Didn't get along with the media.
Right. Didn't like the media.
Babe Ruth was up to his exploits off the field, as was...
Right, but Babe Ruth got in right away.
Right away.
You know.
Because he was great.
Right, right. I mean, and the thing with Larry Walker, and I feel the same way about Jim Rice, and I'm glad Jim Rice is in the Hall of Fame. You know, Red Sox fan. I loved him growing up.
Say,
and all
he
that.
Was your guy, wasn't he?
No, Evans was my guy.
Oh, Dwight Evans, okay.
But Rice was right up there. But, you know, it just seems like if it takes 10 times to convince yourself the guy's a Hall of Famer, maybe he's not a Hall of Famer.
I don't disagree with that.
You know, I mean, that's not to say that everyone should get in on their first try. And trust me, I get the whole, you know, oh, there's only, you know, only a few people have ever gotten in on the first, which I think is a bunch of malarkey. You know? I mean, I think if you're, right. You know, if Joe DiMaggio should have gotten in on his first try.
Well, he wasn't unanimous. Willie Mays wasn't unanimous.
Right, right. Well, that's what I mean. That's like what I mean. Unanimous, right.
It's silly.
Right. But, you know, what they always point to is sort of, well, Joe Namath didn't get in on it, wasn't unanimous. Joe Namath. Joe DiMaggio wasn't unanimous.
Right.
But
Babe Ruth wasn't unanimous.
But if you go back and you talk about those early years of the Hall of Fame, you know, the Hall of Fame started in 1939. They couldn't put everyone in right away.
Right.
You know, so it just the function of numbers was such that, okay, well, some guys couldn't get in right away and didn't, you know, so they need to kind of spread it out a little bit. Well, we're way past that now.
We should be.
And, you know, I mean, one guy didn't vote for Derek Jeter.
One person.
Right. You know, and I'm hoping that we find out why that is, you know. Because I don't know how you convince yourself that he's not a Hall of Famer.
Well, theoretically, the justification you could make, if you don't think that Jeter is in on the merits, is you're assuming enough of the electorate is going to put Jeter in, the 75%, and you have 10 other people who you'd like to vote for.
Right, because you can vote for 10, right?
It's 10 maximum, and
but you don't have to vote for 10.
Correct. You can vote for one.
Right.
You can vote for none. You can vote for 9.
Right.
Whatever number you want. So you might just assume, hey, Jeter's going to get elected. Enough people I've spoken to have him on their ballots. I'm going to vote for this guy who's a little bit down the ballot, but I think that he should gain some steam and get, or like, I'm going to vote for Larry Walker because it's his last time, and I think he should be a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
And if it's between voting for him and voting for Jeter and voting for somebody else, Jeter's already going to get in. Walker needs my vote more.
You know, I think if you truly believe that Larry Walker's a Hall of Famer, hey, you know, God bless you, more power to you. That's fine.
Right.
But if you're doing it because you're trying to be strategic, or you're trying to say, well, he's a good guy, and you know, that's not...
seems flimsy.
That's not why you should be a Hall of Famer.
That's right.
Right. You should be a Hall of Famer because if you're a batter and you get into the box, the other team says, oh, crap.
Right.
Right. And if you're a pitcher and you take the mound and, you know, your team is up by one run, or, you know, you're the batter, your team is down by one run, you don't think you're going to be able to get a hit off this guy.
That's right.
That, you know, that's Hall of Fame quality.
Well, it's greatness. Right. It's the Hall of Fame.
It's consistent
the Hall of
greatness over many years.
Yes, correct.
Right? I mean, we've had plenty of players who... how many of us would have bet that Nomar Garciaparra would not be in the Hall of Fame when he was in the middle of that great run?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, everybody was saying, well, this guy...
Yeah, 2000, 2001.
Late 90s, yeah. Early 2000s. We were like, well, this guy's a surefire Hall of Fame.
No question.
It didn't last that long.
No.
Right? And obviously, there might have been other reasons why that was, but... Yeah. But
we'll get to that later in the podcast.
Right.
Oddly enough.
But the point is, it comes and goes.
That's
you know?
Right.
And with Jeter, it never went.
That's know? Right.
He was always right. Really at the top of the game.
You know, and Walker was enhanced by his environment. Now, he took full advantage of the humidor and playing at altitude and, you know, weak National League in the expansion era because the Marlins had just come in and the Rays had just come in. And
none of these things were his fault, by the way.
None of these things were his fault. Right. He took advantage of great circumstances.
Yep.
You know, he's in. He should be celebrated. He's been voted in.
Yeah.
It is what it is. They're not going to take him out because you and I don't think that he should be in. But, you know, that is what it is.
So, anyway, you did, a very masterful job here of
thank you.
Putting the you're welcome. It's late, so I'm probably not thinking straight. Putting all the players, kind of grouping them into, according to certain themes. Mm. So why don't you take us through the rest of the ballot here?
Well, you started off with the yes, Jeter,
right?
Obviously, the no's on here, and none of these guys ended up making it. Several of them didn't get one vote.
Right, and these are guys who were just eligible because they retired within the window, and now they come up for the Hall of Fame.
Bobby Abreu, who actually got 5.5%.
Yeah, who was a good
stay on the ballot.
Who was a good player, and a very good player in some years, and had a long, very productive career, not a Hall of Famer.
Like, he was fine.
Yeah.
But not a Hall of Famer.
Right.
Heath Bell, no. Eric Chavez, Adam Dunn, Sean Figgins, Rafael Furcal, Raul Ibanez, Paul Konerko, Cliff Lee, Carlos Pena, Brad Penny, J.J. Poots, Brian Roberts, Jose Valverde. None of those players got in, and I think all of them will be off the ballot, with the exception of Bobby Abreu, next time around when we come up in 2021. The yes, Derek Jeter, obviously we've discussed him.
Right.
The next group that you go to, I guess since Larry Walker is elected, we'll skip to the Coors guys. And you've got Larry Walker and Todd Helton are the two most prominent guys on the ballot. Todd Helton got 29.2% of the vote. This is his second year on the ballot.
Okay.
I look at Helton as a guy who's similar to Walker in that he had one top five MVP finish. His splits at 345, 441, 607 at Coors. Away, he was 287, 386, 469. 1048 OPS at home. 855 OPS away. So he's a monster at home,
right,
and human away.
Right.
You know, and I just think that Helton, if I'm going to look and I'm going to say Helton's never won an MVP, he didn't win a World Series, he didn't do things in the postseason that blew you away, to me, he's going to end up paying the ballpark tax. I wouldn't see myself voting for Todd Helton. I think he was a good player. I think he put up good numbers for an extended period of time.
Yeah, he had a couple of years where he was a monster,
where he was
sure.
Really good.
Right.
But to me, I just look at the ballpark and I think to myself, Coors Field helped everyone so much during that era when they couldn't calibrate the balls right, when they were trying to use the humidor, when pitchers were complaining that their breaking stuff was off and not moving as much as it would in other places. I think Helton was a good player who took complete advantage of that, and I couldn't necessarily see myself voting for him.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I mean, I couldn't see myself voting for Larry Walker, and I couldn't see myself voting for Todd Helton. Again, very good players. Love to have him on my team. Is he a Hall of Famer? You know, I think there are some years there that if he replicated those same years more often, then I think I'd consider them more seriously. But I think he's one of those guys that falls just short. He's like the 4A player, you know?
Right. Very good. Only three top tens in the MVP, so not necessarily considered an elite player in a given season among his peers. And that's what this is for. It's to separate the truly elite from the good or the very good. The next block that you would go to, probably one of the most controversial blocks that's going to be on this list, the PED guys. People who have been linked, whether through significant evidence or through the Mitchell Report, or through entire books written about PED use in baseball.
Yep.
Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Jason Giambi, who's going to be off the ballot, Andy Pettit, Manny Ramirez, Gary Sheffield, and Sammy Sosa, who never tested positive, wasn't named in Balco or in Biogenesis or in anything else, but because his totals were so ridiculous for a stretch
everyone
there in the late 90s and the early 2000s,
he was doing PEDs,
everyone assumes that he was using PEDs. Oh. I don't know, Bill, if I've ever asked you your thoughts, whether as a group or individually, on the list of players who I just named.
You know, I think initially, and this is probably true of a lot of people, I think initially, I was against putting any PED guys in the Hall of Fame because I thought, well, you're cheating. You are giving yourself an unfair advantage. But then the problem with me, Bill, is that, you know, we are sort of saying, okay, well, we know these guys have ties to PEDs because they either failed a test, they showed up on a report, they apologized, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that's just sort of a small part of probably a lot of other players who, for whatever reason, never sort of came into the crosshairs.
They got away with it.
They got away with it, and maybe they played in a place where, you know, they weren't looking as hard. So it's hard for me to say, well, I won't vote for Barry Bonds because I know, or I believe that he was a PED guy.
Right.
But I'll vote for somebody else that never showed up on a report, but played in the same era and, you know, put up some good numbers. And I'm just sort of
someone like
giving them the benefit of the doubt that they got away with,
like,
got away with it.
The two guys, I think, who got tagged with that stigma for a while and both eventually got into the Hall, Jeff Bagwell and Mike Piazza, come to mind.
Right.
People sort of looked at them and thought, there's something fishy there about both guys.
Sure.
It's never anything proven. They were never really named in anything. And eventually they did get in.
I think eventually it would be ridiculous not to have the home run leader of baseball in the Hall of Fame and not to have a pitcher like Roger Clemens. My sort of, this is the long way around of saying, I think eventually these guys are going to, if their careers were worthy enough. And I think you can sort of justify it, I think, to some degree, by saying, well, Barry Bonds was more than just a home run hitter.
Right.
Right. He did lots of things very well, especially early in his career.
Sure.
Great defender, had speed, PEDs may not really influence all of those aspects.
Won three MVPs in Pittsburgh before he even went to San Francisco.
So I think they're eventually going to get in. I think if I had the vote, I would eventually relent and probably vote for these guys. Because I just think you'd have this huge time frame of the game where you would just be really, you could never really be sure that just because somebody didn't show up on a report that, they're not tied to PEDs.
Right.
So, and certainly baseball was embarrassed itself, I think, by not really going after it for a very long time.
The shameful thing is that Bud Selig, who, pretty much tacitly approved this by not being able to get testing through, he's in the Hall of Fame and none of these players are.
Right, exactly.
Which is a total joke.
Right, absolutely.
And it's an example of the owners and the Veterans Committee and whoever was in charge of that looking out for one of their own.
Right.
The fact that Bud Selig is in the Hall of Fame and Barry Bonds, who I am not a big fan of at all,
right,
and who I certainly think was cheating and made a mockery of the game's record book, the fact that Bud Selig is in the Hall of Fame and Barry Bonds is not is an absolute joke. Right. It's a ridiculous contradiction.
Barry Bonds could have stopped playing, you know, probably 8 years before he did, and he was probably a Hall of Fame player by then.
He could have retired before he even went to the Giants. And I think he's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, that's true.
He's a three-time MVP.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, I certainly think that he had probably done enough by then. He was already looked at as one of the game's great players.
Yeah, no, absolutely was.
You know, Roger Clemens, if you look at what he did in Boston, it's pretty, if you wanted to make a circumstantial case, toward the end of his Boston career, he's in his early 30s. He's wearing down, it looks like. Dan Duquette sort of declares him done.
Right.
He goes to Toronto, and all of a sudden, he's rejuvenated in 2 years. He wins the Cy Young twice. He wins 20 games twice. And then he moves on and is great with the Yankees and the Astros and wherever else. And he doubles his win total from there. I think he won 192 games with the Red Sox. He finished in the 360s or 370s.
Right, right. Wow.
You know, but all that's after 32 or 33.
Yeah.
And he clearly shown signs of decline. So it's fishy.
Yeah,
when that happens.
It's absolutely fishy.
It's fishy.
And I'm certainly not arguing the case that these guys didn't do anything. I just think it would be hard to start sort of nitpicking and say, well, I think this guy did it, I don't think that guy did it.
Right.
I just think eventually you're just going to... Now, people might say, well, what about, you know, does Mark McGwire get in? I guess the question is, well, if you take away all the home runs, is he a Hall of Famer?
McGwire sort
you know?
Of.
McGwire I mean, his sort of average gets... and on base and all that other stuff. Well, he got walked a lot too, but you know, it's not like he was a great defender.
No,
you know?
he gets sort of labeled the one trick pony.
Yeah, right.
You know, a little bit in that way.
I mean, Dave Kingman hit a ton of home runs in his day too, prior to PED use, and he's not in the Hall of Fame last I checked. So.
Right, you know, McGwire, you're looking at him, he's career 982 OPS, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 top five finishes for the MVP, top 10, sorry. You could probably see a way to voting him in if it wasn't so clear that, you know, he was a steroid creation in St. Louis.
Right.
And pretty much admitted to it in front of Congress. You know, I agree. I had that discussion with Nick Cafardo before he passed, the great Boston Globe baseball writer. And I asked him what he thought about voting for PED users, and he said very much what you did there. You can't necessarily prove who was and who was not
right.
cheating. Some guys got caught and some guys didn't.
Right.
You know, you don't necessarily know if Barry Bonds was hitting 762 home runs against guys who were dirty.
Right.
And if that was the case, then he was greater than them anyway. You know, so it's a very difficult, complex discussion. I think that's why the voting, the standards allow you some latitude, some personal latitude. You can make your decision about what you can tolerate and what you can't. With that, we segue to the next person on this list, who is a category unto himself, former Red Sox right-hander Curt Schilling.
You wrote the infidel on the notes here, Bill.
I did indeed. You've just outed me. I did.
Well,
anyone who consorts with Breitbart and Alex Jones and InfoWars, in my mind, is a fairly reprehensible person and not necessarily putting forth the best reflection of himself or herself in the public view.
But that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not, or at least in my view, whether or not Curt Schilling belongs in the Hall of Fame.
All of that said, I would be voting for Curt Schilling.
Yeah.
I think he is a Hall of Famer.
You know, Curt Schilling is one of those guys that I always looked upon as when he had the ball, you had a great chance to win the game. Now, if you look at his numbers in the regular season, they're not great, but
they're good.
They're not certainly not bad.
They're good,
right? But the thing that would, and I agree with you, I would vote for him too if I had a vote. And the thing that puts him over the top for me, and he's getting closer, right? I mean, he got. What did he get? Like 70, you said 70-something percent?
This is eighth year on the ballot.
Yeah.
He got 70% of the vote.
70. Oh, he needs 75.
He's the first player out.
Okay.
You know, it stands to reason that you could have Schilling, Clemens, and Bonds, who are all in their eighth year on the ballot, all get in at once.
Huh.
If baseball sort of wants to purge sins all in one class,
right.
Whether it's, you know, someone like Schilling who has gone on after his career to sort of stain his public image, and you take Bonds and Clemens, who are the two most noteworthy and preeminent steroid guys, PED guys of that era. If you sort of wanted to have the blackballed class among those three, hell, you could throw Pete Rose in there too. And just
well,
have
that's
like
a different thing. But
you could have like the protested Hall of Fame class, and you get them all out of the way so that you can elect the quote unquote clean guys or the Snow White guys in other years.
So and with Schilling, though, the thing that stuck out to me is his postseason performance. And it wasn't just one postseason. No. It wasn't like he just, you know, he got a hot hand one year. I mean, you know, he went to the postseason several times with several different teams. And I'm reading from your notes here, so I credit you.
Thank you.
For looking this up. But yeah, he's 11-2 in the postseason with a 2.23 ERA, 120 strikeouts over 133 and a third innings. You know, I mean, I was a huge Curt Schilling fan when he was playing for the Diamondbacks and they beat the Yankees.
No question.
Right? and then obviously he came here and helped the Red Sox win the World Series.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, the bloody sock and the ALCS with the Yankees will forever go down in Red Sox lore. I think that from time to time there are players who rise to the occasion on the biggest stage. And he did it not just once, but over several games in several different postseasons for several different teams. Oh, and by the way, during the regular season, he was a pretty good pitcher too.
Yeah, 3,200 innings plus. He was about a strikeout and inning guy, 3.46 ERA, which, considering the era that he pitched in, is pretty good for a starter. But the playoffs, you mentioned it, 12 postseason series. His teams lost two of them.
Right.
The 1993 World Series with the Phillies. And the 2002 Division Series with the Diamondbacks, they were the defending champions.
Right.
Didn't get out of the Division Series. But you look at the rest of his career, that Phillies team with John Kruk and Darren Dalton and Lenny Dykstra, the sort of dirt dogs there, battled their way into the World Series, lost to the Blue Jays. And then with the Red Sox, obviously. In 04, the curse breakers against the Yankees. And then you know, in 2007, a team steamrolled to another title over the Rockies.
Right.
He was phenomenal in those games. You look at specifically Game 6 of the ALCS, the Bloody Sock game in 2004. You look at the way that he got pounded in Game 2. Was clearly not right.
No, obviously.
You know, went out there and took the ball, you know, three games later and was superb. The Yankees weren't anywhere near him. Boston won that game pretty comfortably. You know, granted, they had to survive a swat from Alex Rodriguez at the end. And the umpires got together and got a call or two right. In that one, Mark Bellhorn home run also comes to mind, which they initially ruled a ground rule bubble inexplicably. But Schilling, this is the part that's really going to test the writers in terms of personally, what are your standards? Because there are clauses in the BBWAA's Hall of Fame criteria, their guidelines, that do give you some latitude based on your personal feelings, based on the player's character. You know, Curt Schilling, the last two or three years, you know, and certainly in Rhode Island, his name is mud based on the video game company that went belly
studios,
up, 38 Studios, and the fact that, you know, there was so much money lost, you know, in guaranteed loans and whatever else. But the fact that he's consorting with the likes of Alex Jones, who's a Newtown, a Sandy Hook conspiracy theorist, it's repugnant. It's disgusting. You know, and I certainly would not criticize anyone who couldn't bring themselves to vote for Curt Schilling. You reap what you sow, and he's asked for, you know, that sort of public scrutiny to fall on his personal character. You know, a lot of people will simplify it, and they'll say, well, he supports Donald Trump, so, you know, that's why you don't like him, because you're in the media and you're to the left.
Right.
And
well, I mean, a lot of players support Donald Trump, so.
Baseball clubhouses are very much to the right. It's very much red state America in there. There's no reason that I wouldn't vote for, let's say, the Red Sox players who went to the White House this time to visit with Trump, as opposed to the Red Sox players who skipped out. You know, there's no way that I would sit there and tell you that I wouldn't vote for Chris Sale for the Hall of Fame if he ends up having a Hall of Fame career.
Right.
That I wouldn't vote for J.D. Martinez if he ends up having a Hall of Fame career. It has nothing to do with Schilling's support of Trump. It has to do with some of the personal standards that he's set through some of his other associations. It's just, it's like curdled milk, you know, leaves you with that feeling that you've had a sip of some of that. But for me, personally, for my own standards, for my own feelings, I would be able to sleep at night knowing that I voted for Curt Schilling for the Hall of Fame. I'd feel okay about his performance on the field, the fact that he came through in October, and the fact that, you know, there are some truly terrible people in the Hall of Fame already. I know that we're not supposed to use, you know, if player X is already in, then we can vote for player Y. I get that. But for me personally, I'm willing to put more focus on what goes on the field, and I would be willing to vote for Curt Schilling into the Hall of Fame.
You know, when I was growing up, we all, I think, had our idols, and I had baseball players who were my idols. Mm. But, you know, it's funny. They were my idols because of what they did on the field. I didn't know really anything about them beyond that.
We know more about them now than we ever have.
Probably.
And we still don't know a lot,
right,
for the record.
Right, and that's true. But, you know, but that sort of outlook is still with me today. When I admire a player, an athlete, I'm not thinking about, you know, where do they stand politically. And now, look, if you're Aaron Hernandez, it's a different deal. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you're out there committing crimes, then you know. But if you are just somebody who has a different political take than I do, or, you know, listens to different music than I do, or whatever. But, you know, that stuff, it just, I don't know, that just doesn't enter my sphere of, you know, am I going to make a decision as to whether I like this person or not? I really admire them for playing baseball at a level that I know I could never.
Right.
You know, I mean, any of us who have played any sport, whether it's baseball or basketball or football or whatever, understand our own limitations. We know we were pretty good up to a certain point, and then there was some separation. And here are these guys who probably never saw that separation, or if they did, it was, you know, once they got to the major leagues.
Yeah.
So that's always been kind of the reason that I admire somebody. So I wouldn't have nearly as hard a time voting for Curt Schilling as other people. Doesn't mean I necessarily want to, you know, pal around with the guy if his politics are so different than mine or whatever. But as a baseball player, I think that what he did on the field, I think, warrants consideration. So moving on from Curt Schilling, you have take the wheel here and tell me who we're going to next.
Well, I sort of termed it the rest.
Okay.
And there are a few names that, you know, you're sort of debating on the merits and, mm-hmm. and might be a little less controversial. We're not known PED guys. You know, we're not known to support conspiracy theorists. You know, did not play the majority of their careers in Coors Field, anything
right.
like that. The first guy at the top of the list was Josh Beckett, who didn't get any votes. I don't necessarily think he's a Hall of Famer. I was a little bit surprised that he didn't get any votes when you consider that Adam Dunn, Brad Penny, Raul Ibanez, and J.J. Poots all got one. That seemed a little strange. Beckett in the postseason, sort of like Schilling, was fabulous. 7-3, 3.03 ERA in 14 games.
Right.
He was the MVP of the 2003 World Series and the 2007 ALCS with Boston. Type of guy who you certainly would have wanted to take the ball in a big game. The regular season numbers aren't there. He's not really close to meriting consideration.
Right.
But I was surprised when I saw a zero next to it.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the difference, I mean, I know you compared him to Schilling. The difference in my mind is he didn't do it as often as Schilling did.
Not close.
And
correct.
Wasn't as, I don't think, as dominant a pitcher for as long a period.
Right.
In regular season. Now, obviously, he was great when Boston got him. They got him, I think, in 2006. They won the World Series with him. He won 20 games, I think, in 2007. That was the World Series team that is probably now the greatest World Series team the Red Sox ever had. But we'll see. The report still hasn't come out, right?
We've promised you all the penalty phase podcast on the 2018 Red Sox, and we will do it.
Right. You know, again, Josh Beckett was one of those guys when he was in this prime, and certainly when he was with the Red Sox in that 07 season, he was must-watch TV.
Yeah.
When he was pitching, you wanted to see him because he was so dominant. And he had that great attitude, like, I'm just going to go out and just shove this down your throat.
The famous story about Game 5 in Cleveland, when they brought in his ex-girlfriend to sing the national anthem, and you know, he sort of thanked the Indians in the bullpen, in no uncertain terms to the bullpen coach, and said, for the record, I dumped her. And went out
and had a great game.
It was a little, you know, Beckett could get a little salty.
Absolutely.
He had a little burr under his saddle for sure.
Liked watching him. He's a great pitcher, not a Hall of Famer.
The next guy, Andruw Jones, somebody who, You know, in my mind, Bill, when I think of Andrew Jones, I think of two things. One, how early he broke through
right.
as a player. He's on that World Series stage as a 19-year-old, I think, in 1996 with the Braves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hitting a home run in Yankee Stadium. You know, just the talent and the fact that he's sort of opened a different market in baseball into Curacao,
yep.
Into Aruba, which Red Sox fans should be thankful for Andrew Jones because they have Xander Bogaerts out of that. Andrew Jones won 10 gold gloves in center field, breathtaking ability defensively. He was in the top 10 of the MVP voting twice in the National League. The stunning thing for me when I looked at his numbers was his career basically ended at age 30. Between 30 and 35, his last 5 or 6 years in the league, his slash line, 214, 314 on base, 420 slugging
right.
in 589 games. Now, you heard stories out of Atlanta and in different places where he went that he never really took care of himself,
yeah.
That he sort of liked the nightlife a little bit. You could see that, you know, just pictures of him in the batter's box, the young, trim, fit 19-year-old compared to the guy who was 32 or 33. It was very clear he'd put on a lot of weight.
Yep.
But that drop-off, shocking to me, and,
yeah.
and certainly not a guy
dramatic.
Who I would have voted for.
No. And I think, you know, in my mind's eye, I think of Andrew Jones as that young, fabulous fielder who was a great hitter. But you're right. When you actually look at the numbers, his last 5 years were not very good. He ended with a .254 career batting average, which is not very good.
No.
And he probably played a little too long because he probably wasn't in great shape and he couldn't replicate some of those earlier seasons. And like you said, he broke in at 19. He was in the league for 17 years. It was a long career.
Mm.
So, you know, it's funny. You hear that name and you think, oh, yeah, you think of that mid-90s star with the Braves. But I think he's had too many years where he wasn't close to that. So I wouldn't vote for him for the Hall of Fame either.
Another guy who didn't necessarily get close, Alfonso Soriano, he's going to be off the ballot. Another guy who I sort of looked at his numbers and realized that he wasn't quite up to snuff.
Yeah.
Particularly in the postseason was stunning. You remember Soriano obviously as a guy who would expand the strike zone and sort of swing at anything.
Mm-hmm.
In the regular season, you get away with that. In the playoffs, 44 career postseason games, a 562 OPS.
Wow.
Which is just dreadful. It just think that, you know, last year, given years, Sandy Leone would have like a 600 OPS.
Mm.
So think about that Soriano was worse. And this is a guy who, you know, pushed 40-40 a couple times.
Right.
A guy who was, you know, thin and you looked and the bat looked like a club in his hands. But all of a sudden the ball would just launch off of it and he'd hit it 8 miles.
Right.
You know, but just someone who really, you know, once you take a little deeper examination, was not going to pass the test and get a Hall of Fame vote for me.
You know, when he broke in with the Yankees right around 2000, 99, I guess was his first year. Well, 2001 was the first year he played 158 games. I thought for sure this guy was going to be a lifelong Yankee.
Mm.
He really had that potential of you know, great offensive player. He played at sort of an okay second base.
Right, they flirted with making him an outfielder, a right fielder, whatever.
Right, but I just thought his offense was so good that he would just be there for a long time. And I just thought, well, you know, him and Jeter in the middle of that field.
Mm.
But then, you know, he went to Texas after that for a few years.
He was in the Alex Rodriguez trade.
That's right. Texas for a few years. And then he was with the Cubs for a long time. And again, if you asked me in 2002 or 2003, what do you think Alfonso Soriano is going to be in the Hall of Fame? Well, you know, judging by the last 2 or 3 or 4 years, I would probably have said, yeah, I think he probably, but he never really was able to recapture those same numbers.
No.
And I don't think he's going to get in, and I don't think he should.
Nope. Next guy, Billy Wagner.
Yeah.
Closer, obviously, with several teams.
Right. I always think of him with the Astros.
Me too, the
yeah.
Astros.
Right.
You know, guy who really came of age in the strikeout era. Struck out a third of the batters he faced, 3,600 batters faced, 1,196 career strikeouts.
Wow.
So when you went up there, you didn't have much of a chance to make contact
right.
against him. 2.31 ERA, two top six finishes for the Cy Young. postseason, dreadful. 14 games, 10.03 ERA.
Wow.
Only 13 strikeouts and 11 and two-thirds.
And that's not going to get...
A small sample, but really bad.
Yeah, that's
not
going to get
it
done.
He was on losing teams.
Yeah.
You know, Wagner, I think, maybe goes to the essence of what you think of the reliever in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
Now, obviously, Mariano Rivera is the first unanimous selection to go into Cooperstown. I personally think he's the greatest relief pitcher of all time.
Yeah, I don't know how you would argue that, but yes.
But so I guess you would ask, where is the standard? You've got guys like Bruce Sutter is in the Hall of Fame. Rolly Fingers is in the Hall of Fame. We started this podcast by saying we're not going to go if player X is greater than player
right.
Y and player
right.
Y is already in, then player right. X should be in. We're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But just on the merits, Billy Wagner got, 31.7% of the vote this year. I could not see myself voting for him. I don't necessarily think that he's one of the greatest players, you know, of all time. Someone who has to be there, or Hall of Fame is going to fall down. I think he would fall short for me.
No, I think you're right. Although I have to say, when you go back and you look at his numbers, some of them are pretty eye popping. I mean, if you look at his save totals, he had a year of 39, another year of 39, a 35, a 44, a 38, a 40. You know, so he was pretty good for over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bill, remind me, or I don't know if you know off the top of your head, were the Astros in the National League when he was playing with them, or were
they were?
Okay, so that's probably why I wasn't that clued into him, because we weren't seeing them very much.
That's right. And then he was with the Mets for a little bit,
right? You know, he bounced around. He was with the Mets, the Phillies, the Red Sox actually had him for like a cup of coffee, right?
sort of like how they had Lee Smith,
right?
Way at the end,
right? Right.
When he was
way,
done,
right? Right. Way at the end. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I don't think of him as a Hall of Famer, but his numbers certainly do jump out at you. And I think if his postseason was better than it was, I think maybe he'd at least warrant some more serious consideration. I don't think he's going to ever get in.
No, I'd be surprised if he got in. This was his fifth year on the ballot. You know, realistically, you'd have to have a big push toward relievers getting in,
right?
To sneak him in. Next guy up would probably be. I'd have to take a look, honestly, at Jeff Kent, and this is a guy who I took a little deeper look at earlier today,
right.
And I gotta say, I think I might vote for Jeff Kent.
His numbers are sneaky good.
Sneaky good.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a guy who, like, you know,
nobody liked him.
Well, we're out here on the East Coast.
Right.
He's playing for the Giants for the majority of his career. A guy who wasn't necessarily well-liked either by the media or in his clubhouse.
Right. And I've never had any interaction with him. I don't think
nope,
you have
either.
So who knows? But that's sort of the book, that he's kind of prickly and a lot of guys weren't that close to him and didn't really like
that's
him.
That's the book. And, you know, if I had to spend that much time with Barry Bonds while he's being miserable, I'd probably be in a bad mood as well. You know, but had most of his prime with the Giants, you know, then ended up with the Astros and then the Dodgers. For Kent, you know, just like you said, the numbers are sneaky good. Top 10 in the MVP 4 times. He won it in 2000
yep.
in the National League.
Right.
4-time Silver Slugger. 855 career OPS. And that's over 2,300 games. So he played for a long time. 17 seasons and,
yeah.
and was pretty durable
yeah.
in that time. The similar players to Kent, according to Baseball Reference, some good guys here. Robinson Cano has a chance to get into the Hall
yep.
of Fame. Jim Rice is on that list.
Yep.
Ryan Sandberg is a Hall of Famer. So someone who, considering the position that he played second base, not particularly well, he wasn't a good defensive second baseman,
right,
but at the plate was, you could argue, one of the premier offensive second basemen of his time from the 90s and into the 2000s. I could see a way to voting for Jeff Kent. I think that he might make it onto my ballot.
Yeah, he might. You know, I still don't look at him and say, yeah, he's a Hall of Famer. But, you know, and again, we're not going to do well if this guy got in. Then, but, you know, if Larry Walker got in.
Well, if Phil Rizzuto got in, it's
right.
what you really want to go back to.
Right.
You know.
But, no, I'm with you. I was a little surprised when I went and looked at the numbers that he was as consistently good over a 17-year span in the big leagues as he was. So I think you could do worse than voting for Jeff Kent. He's probably the, you know, if you forced me to vote for a second guy, he might be the second guy, on this list. I don't know that I would, but I think I would vote for him before I voted for Larry Walker.
Now, Kent's 855 OPS was the same as a guy who got 8% more of the vote than him, and that's Scott Rolen.
Mm.
Longtime Phillies and Cardinals third baseman. He was the Rookie of the Year in 1997. He was top 10 in the MVP only once. 8 gold gloves at third base. Another guy who was over 2,000 games. As I said, had an 855 OPS. His offensive numbers were solid across the board. Not good in the playoffs. Only a 678 OPS in 40 games. Really dropped off there. A guy for me who was good player. One of the better third basemen of his era. But I don't know if he rises to the level of, say, Adrian Beltre or Mike Schmidt.
Oh, certainly not Schmidt.
You know, somebody along those lines. You know, Brooks Robinson, who was a great defender for a long time and who won championships with the Orioles. I'm not sure if I could necessarily see Scott Rolen as being that great player. I think he's very good.
Yeah.
And I think he's very good for a long period of time, but I'm not certain I could see myself voting for him.
No, I'm right with you on this one. I liked Scott Rolen as a player. I thought he was a very good player, consistent player. He never struck me as, this is a Hall of Fame player. So I know this is, but I mean, this is only, I think, his third year on the ballot. So,
correct.
So we'll see. I mean, he's still got many years to go. And, it's a Jim Rice syndrome. He wasn't a Hall of Famer for 14, because he was there for 15 years, I think. He was a.
Was Rice during the 15 year period?
I think he might have been during the 15. Yeah, well.
So it used to be 15 years.
Right,
folks,
and now it's 10. Whatever it was, but Rice got in right at the end.
That's right.
And, it's like all of those other years he wasn't good enough, and then all of a sudden he became good enough and he hadn't played a game. So we may see that with Rolen too, but right now I don't look at him as a Hall of Famer.
The last guy that we're going to discuss. I think is sort of a victim of the offensive revolution now. The premium that's placed on doing damage, slugging percentage and, doubles and home runs and whatever else. Omar Vizquel, to me would 100% be on my ballot, appeared on 52.6% of ballots this time, in his third time on the ballot. Mm. So he's a guy who could trend toward induction. Quite simply, I think Omar Vizquel is the best defensive shortstop maybe of two generations, whether it be in the 90s or the 2000s.
Oh, okay.
I thought he was superb at that position. 11 gold gloves.
Certainly in the 90s. It was fantastic.
If you look at the similar players according to Baseball Reference, you're going to hear a lot of Hall of Famers here. Luis Aparicio, Rabbit Marinville, who was like a turn-of-the-century guy in the early 1900s.
Yep.
Ozzie Smith, who I think he probably compares most favorably to. Mm-hmm. Luke Appling is a Hall of Famer. Pee Wee Reese is a Hall of Famer. Nellie Fox is a Hall of Famer.
Right.
I just look at Vizquel and I think he was so great in the field. He played 3,000 career games.
Yeah, he played for 24 years.
had 400 steals.
Right.
Was continuously in the postseason, whether it be with Cleveland or in his other stops.
Mm-hmm.
I look and I think that, yes, he had a 688 OPS, and it wasn't very good, and his batting average was okay.
Yeah.
And I know that that's been de-emphasized. But in terms of the 90s and into the early 2000s, I don't know if there certainly wasn't a better defensive shortstop. I don't know if there was a better defender at any position, period. And I think that, and that's just the eye test. That's not necessarily looking at the metrics any deeper, and I'm sure folks would do that before they cast a ballot for him. But I just thought that Vizquel was something special. And I think that the Hall of Fame is a place for guys who do something a little special.
You were right, because when you started talking about him and you said that the shift towards offense, because you look at his offensive numbers and they don't jump off the page at you, certainly. But if you watch the game and you watch when he played, he was so good at shortstop. He's made everything look so effortless. He had tremendous range. It's one thing to have a few years like that. He was like that for the bulk of his career.
Yeah.
Even when he sort of reached his 40s,
right,
he was still a very good defender.
Played until he was 45.
Yeah, right. So, I think that certainly warrants consideration. Obviously defensive play isn't as sexy. It doesn't, it's not what, no one is usually, as a kid, dreaming of making a play at shortstop as much as they are hitting a home run to win the game.
Right.
But, I would have to look a little harder at Omar Vizquel if I had a vote, because, you know, he was such a good defensive player and he really impacted the game from that, from that position. And he wasn't a terrible offensive player.
No.
I mean, he had a 272 career average. So that's certainly not, that's certainly not bad, but
his career OPS was better than Ozzie Smith. His postseason OPS was also better than Ozzie
Smith.
Right. You could argue whether or not he was the defender that Ozzie Smith was. I think that's splitting hairs.
Right, right.
But Ozzie Smith is in the Hall of Fame, worthy of being in the Hall of Fame, was the best defensive shortstop of the 70s and the 80s. I think Vizquel took that mantle and ran with it, starting with his career in Seattle and continuing on to Cleveland and to the Giants. I don't think that there was anybody you would have rather had out there than him.
Did he ever win a World Series with the Giants in those years? Did the Giants win in any of those years? Because I think that certainly helped Ozzie Smith.
He did not win a ring.
Yeah, and I think that sort of goes against you. It's not fair, but it does go against you. You don't have the eyes of the nation watching you win a World Series.
I know he
lost at least one.
He missed a ring by a couple of years in San Francisco. He was there from 2005 to 2008.
Right. He was on the Cleveland team that lost, right?
Cleveland, obviously. He played in the World Series in 1995. They lost to Atlanta. He played in the World Series in 1997. They lost to the Marlins.
Right.
He lost to that great Pedro Martinez performance in 1999, the Red Sox. Now, the Yankees were a wagon in the late 90s.
Right.
He had the misfortune of playing in the American League while the Yankees were there and came back to power under Derek Jeter.
Right.
And that crew. So he was sort of wrong place, wrong time, being in the American League while the Yankees were strong, and then going to the National League before the Giants really took off.
Right. Again, somebody that I could probably convince myself to vote for as a Hall of Famer, but not on the face of it say, yeah, he definitely is a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, I think I would vote for him.
Yeah,
I do.
Okay. Well, Bill, that wasn't bad. We did it in less than an hour. So I don't know. Maybe something else will come up, like the Red Sox hiring a manager that would warrant us to hold another Twin Bills podcast. Speaking of the Red Sox, so they are, I want to say 3 weeks from pitchers and catchers reporting now, maybe a little less.
It's February 12th, right?
February 11th or 12th, I think. Yeah.
Truck Day, February 3rd.
February 3rd, yeah. Last I checked, they still don't have a manager.
Correct.
I know that Sam Kennedy said something about that he'd like to get somebody on board before spring training. That makes sense.
It's a worthwhile goal, right?
What do you think? Do you think that they're going to find somebody to truly be, to be a real manager, or is it going to be kind of like a stopgap because, the factors of the time and, this is not an ideal time to be looking for a candidate?
Yeah, it's the timing. It's what candidates are on the market. It's who Chaim Bloom knows.
Right.
Because he hasn't spearheaded a managerial hire before. He's been involved with the Rays a couple times, but it hasn't been his show, his production. He's not necessarily picking from a full field of candidates
now. No, not even close.
The time frame, as you mentioned, being compressed like it is, it adds some pressure. I also think that Boston is waiting for the league's results of the investigation in the 2018 Red Sox. And I say that because if Ron Renneke is implicated in some way in that investigation,
you can't
make him the manager.
Right.
I think otherwise, Renneke is in his early 60s. I think he'd be comfortable with being the manager for 1 year.
Right.
If they went to him and said, Ron, we're in a tough spot. You know the players. The players are like you.
Yeah.
You know it's a good team. You have a chance to win. Would you be comfortable just doing this for 1 year and we're going to take 6 months and look for someone long term?
Right.
And then you can decide if you want to continue on with the person we hire.
Right.
Or if you'd like to go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to you. We could reassign you within the organization. You could theoretically, you could retire. He'd be 64 or 65 by then.
Right.
Or he could go look for another job elsewhere, as a bench coach with a manager who he knows, whatever it might be. So I think a lot is going to depend on the league's investigation, with respect to Renicky or Carlos Fabelis or Jason Baratek, anyone in-house.
Right.
And I'm more inclined to think that based on the circumstances, Bloom being a bit new and the field being a little thin, that they're looking to make a one-year hire. Mm.
That seems to make sense. And I think just having a really qualified pool of candidates is important. I don't think you have that now.
Mm.
You know, and so if they are able to get somebody like Renicky who would agree to do it for a year, if there's no sort of stain on him from this investigation,
right?
Or if there's a veteran out there who wouldn't mind coming in and with the understanding that hey, you're going to do this for a year,
right?
And maybe we'll give you a club option for a second or something like that,
right.
But this is not we're not hiring you because we expect you to be here for 5 or 6 or 8 years,
right?
You know, so I don't know if that's somebody like Bruce Bochy, if that's something he'd consider.
Buck Showalter, John Gibbons, yeah, Dusty Baker. Those
right.
are some of the names we've heard.
Sure. Because to me, if you're going to go with somebody like Jason Veritek, it's probably not an interim. Like, Veritek is sort of like, if you're going to hire Jason Veritek as your manager, it would be because you want him to be your manager, and it's not because you want him to just keep the seat warm.
Correct.
At least that's my take on it. So,
I agree with you.
So, you know, now... maybe Jason Veritek will be a great manager. He's obviously in-house, sort of. And again, I think I brought this up last time. I'm not sure how much he wants to do it, if he does.
See, I think he would do it. I think he's been out long enough. I think he would do it.
Okay. But again, I don't think you go to him and say, we want you to do it for a year.
He would not do it to be an interim guy.
Right.
There is no way.
Right.
He would have to be the hire.
Yeah.
Going forward.
Yeah. And maybe he would be a great hire. Who knows?
He'd certainly win the press conferences, we've said.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, we'll see. I mean, Truck Day is coming. We should have like a little pool. Like, do you think they'll hire somebody by Truck Day or after Truck Day?
Oh, that's a good question.
I mean, I'm thinking that they're going to have somebody before spring training gets going for real.
Wow, one of the casinos in Vegas has to have
that. Oh, there's got to be a prop bet for that, right? Maybe Twin River has that.
Could be. Could be our friends at Twin River. We should check in with Andy Gresh. He's over there a fair amount at Twin River doing his show on WPRO.
Right. Yeah, he's saying Andy has the inside track on some of this stuff.
I think he knows some of the folks at the Twin River Sportsbook. Right. I think if they're posting those sort of odds or have some friends in Vegas, he might have a little inside.
We should get Andy. You know, now that the Patriots season is over and he's not toiling away each week on the Gresh's Grades column, maybe he can pop in and enlighten us with some hot picks.
Have Andy turn both barrels on the Red Sox?
Oh, boy.
Outstanding. and he's brimming with all this energy now. Andy Gresh, for folks who don't know, has lost 110 pounds.
I see him on the commercial. He looks great, yeah.
He's sponsored by Awaken 180, which is an all-encompassing weight loss program that addresses not only nutrition, but the mental side of it as well. They offer you counseling and, whatever else.
Are they paying you for any of this?
No, they're not paying me. I think they are paying him.
Right.
But he looks phenomenal. And the fact that he's done that in 5 or 6 months is a testament to how dedicated he is to it.
Yeah. He does look great.
And I've told him, because I've spoken to him a couple times. I've been on a show a couple times. I give him endless credit for being able to make a transformation and a commitment like that. It's something I wish I could do.
Right. But it's certainly much easier said than done.
I marvel at the man.
Yeah.
I do. You know, and a lot of people say, that's cute. You're making a joke. I am not. I couldn't be more serious. I tip of the hat to Andy Gresh for what he's done, really to give himself a chance to be with us a lot longer.
Absolutely. Well, at the risk of making this thing even longer, I will avoid getting into URI basketball talk because that is the sole area of the Pick and Pop podcast. So
Thursday or Friday.
I will leave that to you and Kevin McNamara. Bill, it's been great as usual. And who knows? We may be doing another Moonlight podcast on the Red Sox one of these nights.
All right, Bill.
See ya.